So good afternoon. Before I start, I wanted to say just a little bit more about myself. I'm in the louder. I'm in the. The Spirit Rock IMS teacher training program, which is a 4-year program, and just starting. And so I feel extremely fortunate to be in that. And Gil is my mentor in the program, so I feel happy to be here with you. And as yogis, sort of apologize for practicing on you, but you're practicing on me too, so. So the foundations of mindfulness. We've already talked about the first three, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feeling tones, and mindfulness of mind. So today, we begin looking at the fourth foundation, which is mindfulness of dhammas. One translation of that is mindfulness of truth. Mindfulness of truth. Seeing and understanding these truths is what deepens our meditation, what deepens our meditation in the direction of freedom. A few days ago, Gil spoke about the image of a mountain stream that was clear and shallow and that looks still. But when we put a stick in the water, you can see the currents of the water moving around the stick. With a reference point that's actually still, we can see movement. The movement comes into relief. And I think the same is true for what we're doing here. As we move around outside in the world, the mind sort of seems calm, sort of seems still. But here on retreat, we have a reference point, which is our intention to be here, to be present, to be mindful. And in trying to be mindful, we notice the movements of the mind, all the distractions that pull us away, that make it difficult to simply be here. The strongest, the most powerful of these distractions have a special name in the Buddha's teaching. They're called hindrances. They're called hindrances because they hinder or obstruct our ability to be here, to see clearly, to be concentrated. So if one of your goals is to be more mindful, you know, or to deepen your concentration, these hindrances are very useful to get to know. To get really close to them, to know them, and become familiar with how they operate in us, is extremely important. So the five hindrances are sensual desire, aversion, sometimes called ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. There are five groupings, and sloth and torpor are grouped together, and restlessness and worry are grouped together. And then there's doubt. So, in and of themselves, these qualities of mind, or forces of the mind, are not a problem. Inherently, there's nothing wrong with them. But, when we don't see them, they can control us. They pull us away. They block our ability to be here, see clearly. If you notice one of these hindrances in you, don't feel bad, because they operate in everyone. They're kind of universal. They're part of our humanity, part of our humanness. And if you notice one, it's actually a great thing. They're visitors to the mind. They come and they go. Sometimes they're present. Sometimes they're absent. Sometimes one or more are together. After having meditated for a while, I think that we get so used to the presence of the hindrances in our daily life that we don't really notice them, or we might think that they're a permanent part of us. So a key part of working with them is simply to notice whether a hindrance is present or is absent. Early in my practice, I didn't pay attention to the hindrances much at all. I'm sure Gil talked about them. But couldn't really relate to the list of sloth and torpor. It's kind of, who talks like that? feeling slothful. And so I would sit down to meditate and, maybe do a day-long sitting and just be, lost in my dreams, fantasies all day, reveries. And I did, I just thought that's how my mind is. That's the way I am. Now that I look back, I can see that there are some very strong hindrances that were operating. So sometimes we can be completely oblivious to a hindrance, like sensual desire, and then we're at its mercy. It's like we just indulge in it unconsciously until the point that we wake up and then come back. To the breath, body. So rather than ignoring the hindrances or just indulging them, the Satipatthana Sutta instructs us to understand them. In addition to noticing whether a hindrance is present or it's absent, we're asked to understand how it arises, how it is removed, and how it's prevented from arising again. And the way to do this, or the only way that I found, is to actually turn towards the hindrances. To look at them directly and include them in the meditation. It's a subtle point, but it's like this shift, this pivot is what transforms these qualities of mind, these hindrances, from being distractions or something that blocks our meditation. It transforms them into becoming the objects of our meditation. And so the difficulties that it seems so much like they're obstacles to our practice actually become our practice. The effects of the hindrances are explained by an image of a bowl of water or a pond that is used as a mirror to see a reflection. So when the pond water is clean, when it's still, placid, it works beautifully as a mirror. It really reflects an image so perfectly. When sensual desire is added, it's said that it's like looking at water that's mixed with dye. Something is colored. The perception is colored. The effect of ill will or aversion is like water that's boiling. It's bubbling up from heat, so it can't reflect anything. The effect of sloth and torpor is like the water is overgrown with a thick algae. Restlessness and worry is like water that's stirred up by the wind. Can't reflect, it's too disturbed. And doubt is as if the water is muddy. You know, so just as each of these prevent the water from reflecting, these hindrances distort our perception. They prevent that clear seeing of presence. So to say a little bit about each one, the first is sensual desire, kamachanda. And this is a big one. It's the first one in a lot of lists, Buddhist obstacles. You know, first, I think it's important to note that it's not referring to all desires. And it's specifically about the way we can cling to sensual desire in an unhealthy way or compulsive way. Cling to sense pleasure. You know, it's like desire itself is part of life and is not a problem. But when a desire, you know, becomes compulsive, craving, addictive, this is kind of that, this is where the problem is. And compulsive clinging in any form, it disconnects us from our actual experience. You know, so obvious examples of meditation, you know, maybe something like fantasies, of food, sex, comfort. And they're tricky because fantasies themselves are pleasant, you know. Gil talked about the feeling tone, the pleasant and the unpleasant. But it's really hard to see that at first, at that level of the process, at the level of the pleasant. Usually we're inside the content of the fantasy. you know, one example some of you might be able to relate to. If you've ever tried to meditate at home using your cell phone as a timer, you know, so put your iPhone down and close your eyes, feel the breath, and then ding! Got a text message, something. And it's, and it's great, you know, and it's like, you know, something about that compulsion to check it, or the compulsion to, pulls us away. So sensual desire is can be such a big hindrance to meditation, in part because it is so connected to something basic, to these feeling tones, to the pleasant. You know, we want what is pleasant, and we don't want what's unpleasant. It's so basic. And sensual desire, clinging to sensual desire, can operate on both sides. It's like, for example, a pleasant smell. If you like coffee, a freshly brewed pot of coffee, or the smell of chocolate chip cookies, you know, coming in from the kitchen. But also something unpleasant. It's like if I have a pain in my knee, you can escape from it through a pleasant memory or a pleasant fantasy. You know, it's a sort of a strategy, an unconscious strategy. The same with an unpleasant emotion we may be feeling, sadness or loneliness. Off we go to a kind of comfort food, or comfort food of the mind. So working with this, sometimes it's enough just to notice the desire. And it's like, oh, bringing mindfulness to it, and something gets released. When this doesn't work, there are various strategies to sort of counter the desire. In my experience, I think it can be helpful to try to see the object of the desire more clearly. It's like often there's, a compulsive desire involves some sort of projection, an unrealistic projection onto the object. So to really see it clearly and to try to get closer to it, see it more objectively, more clearly, sometimes that can break the spell. I think traditionally in Buddhist practice, monks will meditate on a corpse, a decaying corpse. And you don't feel so romantic, probably. I haven't done it. During that meditation. It's sort of an antidote. I think it can also be very helpful to feel what it's like to be desiring. When we're in the grip of, of a compulsion, it's actually not very pleasant. You know, we may have the idea that it's pleasant, we may have the idea that it's what we want, but, I don't know why I have the image of like someone throwing money out of the back of a truck on the freeway and people are like, running for it. It doesn't feel that good. So closely related to sensual desire, as well as its opposite, is aversion, ill will. This is the kind of compulsive dislike in all its forms. It includes the whole range from, you know, minor irritation to extreme hatred, for example. Aversion comes from the basic human impulse to get away from what we find unpleasant, from what we find painful. I think in a way anger can often be a strategy, a kind of a secondary emotion that can cover a more primary emotion like fear or hurt. So we don't have to feel those. It's easier to be angry than to actually feel that pain, that fear. And aversion can be felt in the body. It constricts the body and the mind. We tighten and become more reactive. And just like compulsive desire, aversion, ill will, it separates us from ourselves. It disconnects us. It can be a form of alienation from ourselves. So I think things like bringing in things like patience, generosity, compassion, metta, these are all qualities that can counter and neutralize the hindrance of aversion. So sloth and torpor. I think these basically mean a sort of physical or mental laziness, or dullness, lethargy. And it's different from being physically tired. It's like, it's one thing to be exhausted and to have the wisdom to know that my body needs rest. But there can also be, and I've often experienced this, at the end of a day and sitting and it's late and it's like, I feel so exhausted. Gotta be good to myself. Just go to sleep. And, so I stop sitting and I get up and then I go over to pick up the iPad. And then it's like, all of a sudden I have a second wind and I can read the news. I can check email. So the energy is there. But we can't access it when sloth and torpor, this sort of dullness or laziness, you could say, is present. So the traditional ways of countering this are to rouse the body and rouse the mind. Maybe it means doing more walking meditation instead of sitting. Or walking faster. In terms of arousing the mind, I think it can be very helpful to reflect on, why we're doing this practice. Traditionally, reflection on death is, can be something that rouses us, that life is fleeting, and this is a precious opportunity to practice. Sometimes that can wake us up a little bit and energize us. So the opposite of sloth and torpor is this kind of restlessness. Restlessness, worry, agitation. It can be physical. It can be physical or mental. It can take many forms. Feeling of being anxious, unsettled, hyperactive, it can be present in all the different stages of meditation. Even when the meditation is very fine, there can be a sort of subtle agitation. You know, maybe it's so calm, you feel, wow, or get excited about it. And that's also considered part of restlessness. Worry. There's kind of a mental component of that. So to counter this agitation, it can be helpful to make a special effort to cultivate stillness. Calming the body, often through the breath. And then also something about cultivating trust, trust in the practice, trust in the Dharma. You can kind of calm something, settle something. The final hindrance of these five is doubt. This is kind of a specific form of doubt. It's like, I think this form of doubt usually has to do with the meditation practice or our ability to do the meditation practice. So it can be doubt about the practice, doubt about the teachers, or doubt about ourselves. Doubt is something that can be very difficult to see when we're caught inside of it. It feels real. It feels like a truth or something. And it has something to do with a lack of trust or lack of confidence. When a sitting is difficult, the thought may come up, why am I here? Why am I doing this? You know, this wasn't a good idea. I should have spent my vacation, in Hawaii. And even when the meditation becomes very refined, there can be a subtle doubt, a little voice of like, this isn't really happening, or this concentration doesn't really count, or this is not the real thing, or, I can't do this, something like that. So to overcome doubt, you need to see it clearly as doubt, not to believe it. Noting it, doubt. Oh, this is doubt. Noting it can help create a kind of a distance. And so it's said that what counters doubt is developing faith, confidence, trust, trust in the Dharma, trust in the teachings, the practice, and trust in ourselves, confidence in ourselves. So these are the five hindrances. My Zen teacher would often say, the most difficult place to be is here. And I think these hindrances function as strategies. they're sort of our best strategies, you know, for dealing with some aspect of here that we want to get away from, we don't want to experience. It's like, you know, I did not come here to feel that. And it's subtle, and it's unconscious often. Sometimes it's conscious. But it's like we go through this process of avoidance. In this moment, for some reason, you know, we're unable or unwilling to feel what we're feeling. And, you know, so away we go. It's like sometimes, you know, a delicious memory or a delicious fantasy or a really juicy vendetta or resentment. It functions to kind of give us a break from the tedium of the knee pain or your neighbor breathing or, you know, just another period of just sitting and walking, you know. You know, or we use them as a kind of a cover. The Pali word for hindrance is nivarana, I think has the etymological root as a covering. So, it's like, rather than feel these painful feelings of frustration, we can cover them, you know, with some anger, you know, a little more payoff in anger. You know, so it's that other person's fault, you know, it's the reason I can't concentrate is because of that, because of this. You know, so we do this. It's, they're strategies. And I think this practice is always about coming back to the willingness to be here, you know, to be who we are in this moment. I think about it, it's like we're shining the light of awareness on the hindrances, and we're bringing them out from the shadows into consciousness. There's a great quote by Carl Jung. He says, when an inner situation is not made conscious, it appears as from the outside as fate. So something about that, I think, is relevant to the hindrances. It's said that we shouldn't be so quick to get rid of the hindrances because they carry important data for us. You know? They are... You know, they're the characteristic ways that we resist, that we avoid the experience of this moment. So it's like, you know, when we can work closely with them, when we can really see them, they become opportunities to know ourselves better. It's a little bit difficult to describe what it's like when the hindrances are totally absent. And the image that comes to my mind is like, this past year I was swimming, you know, pretty regularly at my local swimming pool. And one day when I went there, there were these paddles, these kind of hand paddles that were sitting on the edge of the pool. And, you know, I put them on just to see if they fit. And they did. And, you know, so I thought I'd try them. And then you probably know what these are, but they cover your hand. And I don't know, I had the idea that they would make me faster. So I you know, you just put it over your hand and you swim. And so I put them on and I started swimming and I swam for about 20 minutes with them. It was fine. You know, I felt a little more sore, slightly tired or something, but okay. I didn't really notice anything. Notice such a big difference. Then I took them off and I started swimming again. And it was amazing. It was so different. It was like there was no drag at all. There was no resistance. I could just cut through the water and just glide. And I felt so light. What happened? You know, it never feels like this when I swim. You know, there was something about harmonizing, merging with the water, and it was so nice. And something like that. Think about that. It's like when the hindrances are completely absent, it's like there's no wind drag. There's no no obstacles. There's no barrier to deeper concentration, to very deep concentration, and no barrier to the factors of awakening, the factors that lead to awakening. And I think, when you notice that the hindrances are totally absent, you may become a lot more interested in the hindrances. It's like, it does make a difference. It really is something. It's not just this abstract list. So classically, freedom from the hindrances is described like this. To be free from sense desire is like being freed from debt. Free from debt. To be free from aversion is like getting healthy, recovering from a physical illness. To be free from sloth and torpor is compared to being released from prison. To be free from restlessness and worry is like being liberated from slavery. And to be free from doubt is like crossing a dangerous land safely. It's a kind of a liberation. One way of thinking about this practice is that there aren't distractions. When we face difficulties, the difficulties themselves become the practice. And we can accomplish this, we can make this shift through the key factor of sati, of mindfulness. The hindrances can only hinder us when we're not mindful of them. So sati, mindfulness, is the key that unlocks this. I also think there's an important kind of a lubricant can kind of oil this lock. It can be so helpful. And that is bringing in a sense of kindness, sense of friendliness, metta, compassion. As I was saying before, it's like the hindrances are our strategies. You know, there are ways of coping. And in their misguided way, they're trying to help us. So it's like, you know, can we meet them without clinging, without aversion, but, you know, bringing in compassion. Something about having a compassionate relationship to our struggle, to our difficulties. This is a poem by Rumi, the great Buddhist teacher. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. I think sometimes the best thing we can do, the only thing we can do, in the face of these forces, is very simply to sit absolutely still in the midst of them. You know, it's like we let the hurricane of emotion come in and just wash over us. We don't suppress it. We don't indulge it. We don't believe it. You know, we just stay still, right in the midst of it. You know, we become the still observer of our own process. Many of you know the teacher Suzuki Roshi, who was the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, which is a place where I practiced. Many of us here have practiced, Gil has practiced. In the middle of an intensive meditation retreat, he gave a Dharma talk, and the Dharma talk consisted of only 7 words. That's a lot better than I did today. And it's simple, but I think it's very deep. So, to all the monks and the meditators, with aching knees and sore backs and shoulders and been sitting for days and days, you know, in our minds, in our stories, in our worries, in our fears. He said, please don't be bothered by your mind. So I say, please don't be hindered by your hindrances. Thank you for listening.